Perhaps the most remarkable wildlife who inhabit this wilderness are the porcupine caribou. There are 180,000 of them, and their very existence depends on the coastal plain of the refuge as the birthing ground for their young. Each year, as they've done for thousands of years, the caribou begin a difficult and long migration from their winter home in the Canadian mountains to the coastal plain. So strong is their instinctive drive to reach this area, the pregnant mothers risk their lives in a dangerous exodus. Many perish in their unsuccessful attempt to navigate the treacherous Porcupine River. But once they reach the plains, they're rewarded with a tundra rich in nutritious plants and flowers, providing a peaceful haven for bringing their offspring into the world. Now this precious wilderness is threatened. The land and all its creatures are extremely vulnerable to human disturbance. Yet some big petroleum companies and the Bush administration want to invade the refuge because it might contain some oil. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is situated in the northeastern corner of Alaska, the only remaining stretch of the entire Alaska coastline still off limits to oil drilling. The coastal plain of the refuge is the living and breathing heart of wildlife and the target of the big oil companies. They claim they need to drill here because of the growing demand for oil. America does have a tremendous thirst for oil, consuming over 17 million barrels a day, and it is increasing. By far the biggest demand for oil comes from transportation, requiring 63% of our daily consumption. Nearly 25% is for industry, and the rest is divided between utilities and residential and commercial users. While the United States is one of the biggest oil consumers, we have some of the smallest reserves, making us increasingly dependent on imported oil. But the supply of oil that may lie in the refuge is relatively small.
The Interior Department estimates that there is about a 1 in 5 chance of drilling for oil, or of finding oil in the Arctic Refuge. If we find oil, if we win that 1 in 5 bet, they estimate that the average amount of oil is about 3 billion barrels. That's about enough to supply the nation for 200 days. Stated differently, it's about 2.5%, 3% of our current daily consumption.
In fact, if our oil demand grows at its current rate, domestic petroleum reserves will be depleted within the next 15 to 20 years. That's why NRDC is taking the lead in promoting an alternative energy policy.
NRDC is very careful in being responsible about energy development. We recognize that this country needs energy.
NRDC has carefully studied energy options and concluded that efficiency and conservation offer a more responsible program for America's long-term energy needs. For example, improving fuel economy standards to 40 miles per gallon for cars and 30 for trucks could save more than 20 billion barrels of oil by the year 2020. Improving energy efficiency in buildings and increasing mass transportation could save another 24 billion barrels. Combined, they would save more than 10 times the amount of oil that might be found in the refuge.
Drilling for oil is expensive and it's temporary, and of course it causes tremendous environmental harm. Energy efficiency is cheaper, it's permanent, and it does not cause environmental harm. So in the short term, in the long term, efficiency is the best option as a national energy strategy.
Not only is exploring for oil in the Arctic Refuge unnecessary, but the environmental impact could be devastating.
One of the persistent myths has been that oil development can take place in an environmentally sound manner. Well, we think that's a contradiction in terms. Oil development involves heavy industry. It involves tremendous amounts of waste. It involves tremendous destruction of habitat. And what we've seen in the past when the oil industry has moved into sensitive Alaskan areas is a very heavy toll on wildlife and on wilderness, and we don't want to see that repeated in the refuge.
Just to the east of the refuge is Prudhoe Bay, site of a massive drilling complex. Despite oil industry assurances that there would be minimal impact on the environment, it has been an ecological disaster. NRDC has issued landmark reports citing numerous violations of environmental standards by the oil industry, and they continue. Air pollution is worse than in many major cities, contributing to global warming. Toxic waste leaks and spills, buildup of solid waste and garbage, release of chemicals and other pollutants into nearby waters have all contributed to the permanent destruction of fish, wildlife, and their habitats. The threat of oil spills always hangs like a dark cloud over wildlife in Alaska. The Exxon Valdez tragically demonstrated what environmentalists had been warning of for years. Another spill of this proportion can happen again. The intrusion of man, industrial machinery, and supporting roads and facilities would upset the delicate ecosystem of the wildlife refuge.
In other parts of Alaska, when the oil industry has moved in, wildlife has moved out.
NRDC is leading the fight to keep big oil companies from exploiting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for profit. They are taking the battle to Capitol Hill to warn of the environmental dangers of drilling in the refuge and to promote a responsible energy program of efficiency. NRDC has successfully fought the oil industry's previous attempts to develop this wilderness area. But now the stakes are higher and the threat more urgent.
It's our land. It's public land. These are not lands that are held privately. These are lands that belong to the entire population of this country. And it's really our responsibility to make sure that they're administered and managed properly. If we don't do it, believe me, we cannot count on the federal government to do it.
I've been hiking in the Arctic Refuge. I've been hiking all over North America. And the Arctic Refuge is the most pristine, the best wilderness experience that I've ever had. It would be an incredible shame for the American public and future generations to lose that tremendous wildlife and wilderness resource.
I think the American people are tired of allowing the oil industry into every single area that it wants to go into. And I think the Congress will ultimately stand up to big oil and say, no, this one area is off limits. You have access to almost every other part of Alaska. And we're going to save this one part for wildlife.
The greed of big oil could destroy one of the last remaining jewels in the once gleaming crown of American wilderness. The fate of this spectacular land and all its precious creatures is now at hand. The outcome may depend on you.
Well, first of all, any comments on the video itself? Not the issue, but the video.
Is it all done?
Well, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Beautiful.
Sort of one-sided, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty powerful stuff.
Well, I said that this was going to be a discussion of environmental ethics. And I can't ethically have a discussion of ethics without presenting both sides and hearing from everyone. Before we get into it any further. And I also have to state that I know exactly what I feel we should do on this issue. I'm going to urge you to do something. And that I'm a member of a half dozen of the national environmental groups, and each one of those groups is positive on what should be done. I'm going to urge you to write your congresspeople, write your senator. I'm going to give you the number of the bill and say, you know, Do you agree with me or not? If you agree with me, I really think that it would be a good thing for you to write your senator and say no. Now, if we're going to use this as a case study of environmental ethics, I think a good place to start, well, what would be a good place to start? This is something that just...
Do you think this is a good case? Do you?
Now, what do you mean by a good case?
I think this is easy for me to decide on, so I don't think it's a good case.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, maybe... Okay, the priority of this class is not to learn how to do environmental ethics. The priority of this class is this issue. I wanted to promote this issue. I wanted this to be discussed. Okay, the side benefit of it is on how to do ethics and how to do environmental ethics. We all have to make choices all day long. You're going to do this or you're going to do that. Either you know something that there's a situation. Are you going to do it or are you not? And it happens 100 times a day. How do you decide whether or not to do something? How do you make your decisions?
Depends on the decision.
Learn the facts.
Okay, the flip side to this now, okay, so they all come to goes in, what are the alternatives? Where else can they go and what other resources? Or do they go about?
We're going to get into that in just a minute. I'm just interested in right now have a brief discussion on what do you think of? How do you make decisions on everything? What you're going to have for breakfast, whatever. Listen, I know this sounds silly, but I'm trying to get you to start talking.
Okay, what's available? What time do we have? Learn the facts.
Mm-hmm. How inconvenient will it be for me, or how convenient?
Mm-hmm.
How does it affect other people?
And
right or wrong.
Something that goes behind that.
In the light of God's word, what do we do with His creation?
Okay.
What do we give up?
I think a couple things that are pretty basic things are your experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, a lot of decisions you're going to make is already. From your experience, you know this is a good thing. And you're going to have to be challenged with a new piece of information to make you reevaluate that. So, like saying something about, you come to Holden and all of a sudden, you know, maybe you never recycled, you don't have recycling in your neighborhood, and you always threw everything in one trash can. Now you come to Holden and there's 3, 4, 5, 6 trash cans. And so all of a sudden, you've got a new piece of information there. And so you have to learn whether or not to do it. But before you even do that, you have to say, well, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? So part of that is going to be how would you decide whether it's good or bad? One of the things that I'm going to not take for granted, but think that what most people in this room would base their decisions on is their Christian commitment. That we all have been, part of our experience is what we've been taught. And with a lot of us, something that has a lot of weight, a lot of importance, is what we've been taught that God's will is. And you're also going to, other things is you're going to be taught how, you know, in your public school education and maybe your college education, you've been given a lot of different viewpoints. But we all had civics classes. We were all been given classes on what to do to be a good citizen. So I think some of the things that are always in every larger situation when you're making a choice is you're going to think about, well, what does my church tell me? What does reading the Bible tell me? But what does the government tell me? What does my culture tell me? all these things play into.
But this picture told me, I don't see how they're going to make any money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, greed really runs this world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
Which makes one wonder if the other side is, I mean, I don't think they would be going in there if there's only a small quantity of oil, they wouldn't pay to go in there. So it sounds like we're not getting the whole story because they're not going to go in there, you know, if it's not going to be profitable. But yet the motive is greed, so it doesn't make sense in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering too, it seemed like a very small percentage of oil was predicted there. I never heard that before. I always heard much bigger amounts being predicted in that particular area.
Right.
When, what is the truth?
That's interesting that you would say that. What is the truth? I think that in, I know what I want done in this situation.
Then why?
Hmm?
What are your reasons?
Oh, my reasons?
Yeah.
We'll get into that.
Okay.
But what I was going to say immediately, whenever I pick up anything, you know, I'm a little suspect from either side. I'm just from my sentiments and all, I would be a lot more suspicious of something coming from, in this case, the oil industry, and coming through a paid advertisement. Okay? And that's because I have a little bit of journalism background, and I studied advertising in college and public relations. And so I'm very suspect of everything that comes out of that. But I'm also suspect of some of the things. Well, I'm suspect of videos that come from any movement, it doesn't matter.
I'm suspected of you because you belong to 6 organizations.
That's right.
It's all the same aim.
It's all the same aim. I mean, these are just the ones that you know of. You know, I belong to Sierra Club. I belong to Audubon. I belong to NRDC. Different.
We may agree with you on some of the things that therefore we may disagree.
Right.
With
right.
Right. And this is to be a discussion, right? But something you said was, I think even more than I want this. I haven't stated it yet. You know, I do want this piece of wilderness kept the way it is forever. And so I know that what I want is that the bill in the Senate, Bill S-341, which authorizes oil development in the Arctic Refuge before the end of the year, I want that defeated. I've already written my senator, asking him to vote against Senate Bill 341. And the second bill, Senate 279, which spares the refuge by requiring increased automobile efficiency standards. There's a second bill proposed by another group of senators, and it's called Senate Bill 279. It spares the refuge. And part of that bill is it requires increased automobile efficiency. There was a bill in the last session of Congress urging that the miles per gallon would be raised from something like 20 now to, it puts it on a timetable to by a certain year, I don't know if 2020 will be 40 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
It's so very reasonable as far as I know.
So they get both go through.
Right.
So that's the reason.
Right.
To try and get one through that you might not be for,
right.
But you're for the other one, and
right.
So they both go through.
But
okay, the video says 3.5 billion gallons or whatever.
That's what it said it would say.
Okay, what does the oil company say?
Well, I don't have the oil company literature in front of me.
How are we going to get both sides?
Is it really worth it?
Well, I think we can discuss it without knowing what either side is guessing, right? You know, it's if you know anything about oil and how oil companies work and everything, you've got no idea what's going on until you've counted how many barrels you've gotten. You know, it's all a gamble. Now, what the oil company is doing is, back to what Carl said, you know, now if there's only a 1 in 5 chance of hitting oil, that kind of made you suspicious, right? You know?
Yeah.
Well, that's actually pretty darn good to an oil company.
Actually,
they will jump at those odds.
Yeah.
Well, not so much the chance as the amount that after they do
hit.
Yeah.
That amount sounds so minute.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it'd be worth what you have to go through to drill for oil in the Arctic.
Yeah.
The geologist that was here a couple of weeks ago said that actually the odds are more like 1 out of 20 actually finding oil.
1 out of 20 finding oil there? Yeah.
Well, any place, any time, any odds, wherever they go.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to finish up the one point. One point is deeper than what how I happen to feel about this one issue, and I told you how I felt about it, I think it's more important that truth be served, right? So, you know, I mean, that's a deeper level. And behind the truth is, for me, is my Christian commitment, you know, and that sort of tells me how I find what truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And, we talk about our experience and what all goes into, you know, our makeup, you know, and who we are. You know, for me, I know that when I start talking about something like greed, that goes straight to scriptures,
mm-hmm.
straight to our scripture, and it's talked over and over again. And so I don't find it surprising at all that this is what we're talking about here. You know, I think that what this is an example of is greed.
Well, see, that's what I haven't been able to see yet from the information I have,
mm-hmm.
because the amount is so minute, the job is so tremendous that it's not going to be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
To them from the facts that we got from that.
Okay.
I would like to hear your reason why you want to keep it just the way it is.
Okay. I want to hear what Carl's question is too.
Okay.
Well, also, you know, I think we use the oil company as a scapegoat in that their profits are only possible because of our consumption.
Right.
And, you know, we're making them out to be the bad guy. You know, and kind of hiding behind them. You know, it's the same kind of mentality where people refuse to go to Exxon anymore because they had a well-publicized oil spill. So
mm-hmm.
they go to Chevron instead.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't change our driving habits.
Right.
And it's, I think we need to deal with our own, you know, lifestyle issues and all before we, you know.
Right, I'm glad you brought that up because we are going to talk about that. Because that's sort of
it's
the way we're working, because it's still a matter of greed.
It's still our consumption.
It's our consumption.
Sure.
Which comes down to greed. I think greed is behind our consumption, because we don't want to give
That's
up
right.
things.
That's right.
Okay. Now, what was your question again?
You said you're convinced you want to keep that
mm-hmm.
Refuge
mm-hmm.
that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
I would like, because see, we're talking about truth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to get truth.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you like to have that kept just the way it is? What are your reasons?
Yeah. Yeah, my reasons are the way I feel about wilderness. Part of that, I think, is just sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Just sentiment. That I have this idea in my head that that wilderness is something beautiful.
I do too.
And that we should set aside part of it for people like myself and others to enjoy. Perhaps.
How many people go to that refuge every year?
Very few. And that we should set aside these areas of wilderness for people forever. Because once wilderness is damaged, it's changed. Once wilderness is changed, it's changed forever. That's why we talk about low-impact camping here and things like that.
I retired from the National Park Service, so I know about impact.
Right, right.
Isn't it kind of greed when you say you wanted to keep it for yourself? Aren't you keeping it for well, that you really want to preserve the caribou?
Now, why in the world would I want to do that?
I don't know, but that,
I think he forgot to say that.
No, I'm glad that you brought that up. What do people think about that idea?
Well, I don't think I probably will ever get to go there. I might, you know. And very few people, like you said, are going to see it. But we saw pictures of it. And we can certainly enjoy it vicariously, if not. And it's just part of God's creation that mankind really shouldn't spoil.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have some of God's creation left like it was.
Well,
what about this idea? What about this idea that just doing it for the animals? Why would we want to do that? What powerful reason would we have for doing that?
And that's part of the habitat. Many animals are kind of extinct because of human beings.
Why should we care about that?
Once it's gone.
There's a balance in nature that's supposed to be preserved for some reason or other. I don't know all the scientific parts, but we probably have a certain bug because of something else that's been destroyed.
Sure. I looked for mountain goats, but I haven't seen any.
If you want to see mountain goats, go to Olympics.
You got them there?
They were misplanted from another area, and now they're so prolific that they're spending thousands of dollars removing one.
Did they spoil the balance of nature that God created originally?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the reason I would say about this, you know, saving the land for the animals, I would say I would find powerful reasons in Scripture and in my culture for doing that. That there's a lot of stories from Native Americans, and I don't even need to go from Scripture. Lessons that I've learned in school and everything else that wilderness is a good thing, that animals are good, and that they enrich our lives,
mm-hmm.
And just maybe just vicariously. Yes, I always turn to Scriptures. I know that I do a thing here called Creation Awareness Bible Study, and I stress that from the first book of the Bible in Genesis to the last book in Revelation, God tells us that creation is good in and of itself. It's not good just because it's a stockpile of resources for human beings to use. You know, in the first chapter of Genesis, it says, at the end of each day, and God said it was good, and God blessed creation. And all that's the story all throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in the end of Revelation, it talks about that creation is good in and of itself, and that God is going to have a new creation. Now, what else?
To me, it's just a simple fact, we cannot go on forever just taking it wherever it pops up and wherever there is something. I was thinking more of the second bill you mentioned there, where what was all in there, producing cars with less fuel consumption.
This is something we've had in the past, was certain standards for raising the standards on how many miles per gallon a car should get.
Yeah.
And then... and that came into effect in the 70s. And then we've had a different ideology, different brand. Well, that was a Democratic president that did that. And now we have Republicans since 1980, and they relaxed those standards.
I like to, along that line, support the idea that we do have to have tankers with double hulls. And I don't know, is that done now when they are built? Are they out up to standards now?
Because the ships?
From Alaska, that is a fact. And there are many things that can be corrected and now prepared with this Exxon spill will never happen again. Kevin.
It already happened in Washington State.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think...
Wasn't there a spill last month?
That was due to a collision.
Yeah, it was a collision thing.
But if they had a double hole, it might not have...
Well, it wasn't even an oil cut.
No, it wasn't.
They're
saying that more oil is spilled just from garages into sewer systems than there is in any of the oil spills from the big tankers. And that's just individuals that are doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would we call that?
I mean,
yeah, but what's the reason for that?
Carelessness.
Carelessness. I have this. There's a resource available for $2 in the resource center. It's a report that was prepared and adopted by the Presbyterian Church USA last year. It's called "Restoring Creation for Ecology and Justice," and they say that that all the environmental issues are all social justice action issues, and that everything, the way we should look at the way we act is love with justice. Love with justice. Love always paired with justice. And what they say, one of the things they return to is that it's carelessness and greed are the main reasons for environmental degradation. And both those things are, if you've ever heard of the seven deadly sins, greed is one of the seven deadly sins, and so is sloth. Another word for sloth is carelessness. So we're getting down to pretty primary, basic stuff here.
Well, you know, the big thing, laziness or apathy.
Yeah, the same thing. Sloth would be apathy. Would include apathy and laziness.
But then when you hear that only one out of four people, you know, Christians, that's quite a minority.
In this country?
What are you talking about? Yes, in this country.
The statistics I hear are much higher than that. We have, as far as Western countries, we have more people in this country profess Christianity by far. I think in maybe in Europe, it might be something like that. I think in countries like Sweden and Germany, they have 5-6% of the population are members of a church and attend. Agnes, is it something like that in Germany? Is it about 5% people attend church?
I can't
quite
estimate that.
Yeah. That's what I, in Sweden, that's what I understand. And in this country, now, it's interesting, we have people like Martin Marty, who was a professor at University of Chicago that studies religious movements in the country, and I read something recently, he commented on a poll done recently, and it's just amazing, actually. About 60% of Americans declare themselves a member of a certain Christian church. And that's very high.
But do we make our decisions in the light of our Christianity all the time? You know, I'm just learning how to do that.
Well, do we?
I'm old.
Well, I know people who are not Christians, and they are very concerned about the environment, and that goes for Germany too. Mm-hmm. In fact, they never step foot in a church, but they are vegetarian, they are very environmental conscious. So there are others out there that certainly support you, but are not claiming to be Christians.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I think that goes for the United States.
Well, in this particular issue, I don't feel I have enough facts to make a decision. Now, if you want to talk about the Colorado River and dams and what is happening here, I think this is crucial that we do something about that. But with the facts that I have, it sounds like nobody's going to be able to fulfill their greed by drilling that oil well.
No, see,
and
I always paired greed with lust in my mind. I don't know about you. I don't consider greed to be an entirely logical thing. I don't think it matters that we know how much oil is there. And what the chances are...
They're not going to hurt the environment, is what I think.
Hmm?
If they go broke, they're not going to hurt the environment.
From an economic standpoint, I can't see if that's all that they're going to achieve out of that remote area, and the cost, it's not cost effective. to even going and whatever it is that...
Is a power struggle? So many big companies take things and write them off, you know?
Yeah, that's a possibility too. Another thing that I object to in our government is this tying together our senators and so forth, tying together two bills, and if you want one of them,
yeah,
you have to vote for both of them.
Yeah.
And I am very abject to, I object to that system completely.
So don't those two bills go together though?
No.
I think what she's getting at is that oftentimes a bill in Congress.
I think the one he
read.
We know that, but we're talking about this one.
Okay, read it again.
They're giving them until 2020 to improve auto efficiency. They could do it in 5 years if they wanted to. Why give them 30?
I don't.
That's my objection to that.
You know, we're dealing with a couple of things here right now. One thing is you brought up is the way senators write bills, and
yeah,
and I just like to...
I'll help you if you help me, so let's put
yeah
these together.
Yeah.
We'll leave Alaska
yeah
parks alone.
Yeah. That's kind of another subject. That's kind of another subject. And, but in defense of that, I would say, and you can come back and say something, but in defense of that, I'd say that they're clear about what that bill is for. And to tie... to tie energy efficiency and not, oil, gasoline efficiency along with drilling for oil is not like some bills where they put a completely unrelated thing
yeah
and try to sneak it through. So the person, the senators have to, congresspeople have to make a choice between, well, do they really want this one thing bad enough to accept the lesser evil
mm-hmm
sometimes.
But I also agree with you that if we don't need 2020 to make it, it's available right now.
Yeah, they could have already done it.
Yeah.
So you're
it is greed that's already
you're
done this.
You're giving in on that, giving in 30 years, that's what I don't
yeah the, now, does everyone know about why drilling in this particular area is so sensitive? That... it being in the Arctic Circle, it being so far north that it's a specialized environment, specialized vegetation, and that...
permafrost never comes back.
Yeah,
right.
That's my understanding of it.
Sort of preserves
yeah
the damage is preserved.
Once the permafrost has been disturbed, it's like a festering wound that never will heal.
Yeah. I can pass this around, and then this will be in the resource center. It's called Tracking Arctic Oil, the same name as the video. But I'd just like to point out that each day, oil industry operations on the North Slope generate 3,000 cubic yards of drilling waste, which can contain toxic metals and additives. 40 million gallons of produced water are toxic brine, which is brought up along with oil from wells. 40,000 gallons of liquid oily waste and 300 cubic yards of oil contaminated sludge waste and sludges. That's each day.
What do they do with all of
that?
They just dump it?
Yeah. A lot of it is in holding.
Any
is in holding
type of
pens.
Mining does that.
Hmm?
Just about any type.
Yeah,
of drilling or mining, there is damage to anything they do.
Yeah.
Some areas can be recovered.
Yeah, in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Some take longer.
I would think that...
then technology needs to be developed to do something with the... to see where that stuff can be recycled.
But
it can be...
I would argue that it's simpler than that. That all we need to do is quit burning oil.
No,
that we don't need to be drilling for oil if we don't need to be burning it. You know, I was kind of hopeful that, before we started a bombing war, before we started a land war in the Middle East, that some rational minds would say, well, maybe we ought to cut back on our oil consumption.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we ought to just let this guy have his oil.
There were very faint voices saying things like that.
How many of us would be here if it went for oil?
Well, there are alternatives, but there's been very, very definite opposition to some of the alternatives, and they've created alternative opposition to such a great extent that it has become financially unacceptable. Costs too much money to create some new alternatives, to continue with some new alternatives. Rules and restrictions and different kinds of things have been placed upon some of the alternatives.
But I cannot see a car that takes less gasoline being so expensive versus the big boxes that drive on here, you know. What are cars costing? I bought one that cost $8,000. I mean, most of them are $15,000, up to $20,000. Mm-hmm. And
that, so... cost has become extremely...
You live in Detroit, and I deal with, you know, I've experienced with a lot of people. And they tell me that to produce the $7,000 car that gets the highest gas mileage is not profitable because the American people want the more expensive cars, but use more.
There's more profit for them in more expensive cars. Mm-hmm.
At the end of World War II, some of the car manufacturers bought a lot of the public transportation, and they just simply let them break down. They didn't refinish them. They just let them break down, and then they were trying to sell cars. And so they just simply, they're just getting selling cars. And then since then, they have just simply made those great big freeways, and the cars just, the cars are just filling all those freeways, but each car has just one person in them.
Mm-hmm. Right. When
I'm driving from Olympia up to Seattle, I just was just looking at all the cars, and I saw some, just a few of them that had just two or three people in those cars.
And there was one in your car.
What?
There was one in your car. You?
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yes. That's right. Some of it is true, but because of the unavailability, you're forced to be.
To do is happy.
Society is forcing things on people that maybe in the past were not.
But when one time I was driving up there, I was just looking and I was just thinking, now how many people are in a mile? And I would say, maybe just some of those people were in that whole mile, that they would just be put in one bus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many people are on the road because there is lack of public transportation?
All these things point to public policy, and we are the public, and we definitely can affect public policy. Now there's things going on right now. You know, our president has submitted what he calls an energy policy. And part of that energy policy is that, I don't know if it's part of that or at the same time he's submitting a bill where he's urging that we spend quite a lot of money on fixing up our nation's highways and a very small amount on public transportation. As it is, public transportation is in trouble in all our major American cities.
Not the railroads. They seem to be saying they're filling up and they're getting better. I just read an article about that. Would that be public transportation?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, the way we treat it, we subsidize Amtrak. I don't think that it was in the news quite a lot, maybe 10, 20 years ago, that Amtrak was subsidized a great deal.
Yeah.
But you don't hear about it anymore. I don't think that it's subsidized or to the same amount. But, it's like, well, why don't we take public transportation? Because it is there for people that come here from Chicago, Minneapolis, Fargo, a lot of places. Isn't Fargo on the Amtrak line? Didn't we go through it? There's a lot of places that it would be very easy to come to Holden on the train. You take the train to Wenatchee, The bus from Wenatchee to Chelan, the boat from Chelan, the bus from Lucerne up to Holden. Why don't we do that?
There's quite a few people from that area come that way. Groups from Minnesota, Iowa. I don't know about Fargo.
Well,
we Washingtonians are probably more guilty of not doing it because it's, we're within driving distance, so we drive. Mm-hmm. It's more convenient.
Okay, convenience.
It should be more day-to-day stuff. I mean, these long trips should take the case with it. You know, where I live out in a rural area, there's no public transportation. Maybe once every other day a bus goes from one larger or small town to another larger small town. You know, you have to have your own car to drive around or you don't go anywhere.
Yeah. Well, there are places that you have your own transportation is necessary. You cannot rely on public transportation. Then your choices would be, well, what are you going to use for your own transportation? And that's often going to be a gasoline-powered automobile. And so then you look at what kind of gasoline-powered automobile you're going to drive.
I don't know about it's been a while since I've driven in a car into the bigger places. But in Phoenix, they've just completed some of the I-10 was just finally finished through Phoenix. It took them 20 years to get that last section done. But when it was finished, there is a special lane that is marked with a diamond that only vehicles with two or more people can travel on that lane.
Isn't that amazing? You only need two people to.
Well,
that marks you off as something special that you would have two people in your car.
It's recognized. Now, the other thing that the Phoenix area has done is that they have designated to not drive one in five, and they tell you what license number. Like, if your license number starts with a 0 or a 1, you don't travel on Mondays and 2 to 3, you know, on Tuesdays and Saturdays. And they publish that on the TV that, you know, if your license starts with such and such, you know, do not drive today, you know, drive with someone else. And you know, there's public, constant public admonition to get more than, you know.
I've never heard of that. That's in Phoenix?
That's in Phoenix.
Why would they do that?
Because of pollution. We have because of pollution. Very, very severe inverse, inverted.
Inversion.
Yeah. We have a very bad inversion temperature and atmosphere in the Phoenix Valley. I mean, in the valley itself. It's a very large valley, but because of the temperature inversion that we do have, emissions are trapped. And
then what happens?
Well, you get a nice brown.
Everybody has to stay home because they can't breathe.
And smog, and it's becoming worse and worse because of the number of people that have moved into the valley.
What does it do? What does pollution in a situation like that do? I mean, we're not just talking about our aesthetic senses being disrupted, right?
I don't travel on the days that there's a severe
kills vegetation.
Because you have trouble breathing on those days? Is it? Okay, I'm just going to make an outlandish statement, you know, and then we can discuss it. You know, are automobiles killing us? Are automobiles killing us?
Probably. I think so.
You think so?
Los Angeles area.
You know that after they were just simply, everybody was just driving one car, they would just not park downtown because there was no place to park. And so then the companies just simply took out their buildings and made a mall. And they just took as many places to park. And then all the cities now are just stretching out. And that you just simply cannot get on a bus to get out to a store. If they would just simply have public transportation, that you would just have to go any place.
I heard a speaker say that our country, the United States of America, operates at a 7% handicap compared to other industrialized nations, just in the way we get our workforce to the places where they work. That in every other industrialized nation, they've got, most of them, a rail system that will move people to work. And that that we waste so much time, and mainly time is what...
Industrialized.
As far as space.
Ironic thing is, a lot of these cities have public transportation. I mean, they have big speed cars with electric, and big companies, you were saying, come in and offer them cheap buses and cheap gas and get away with the public transport system and cover up the railroad tile. They have mass transit, these have the
mm-hmm.
car system. Way down, 45 miles, 50 miles. Getting into the
mm-hmm. Well, we need to wind up because we've been going at it about 55 minutes or so. But before, I just wanted to say that something that we didn't get to, another reason to leave this land wilderness, is this is the Indian report from the Friends Committee on National Legislation. This is a very good organization. They do great work, and for $20 a year, you can receive their monthly or quarterly bulletins, which tell you what bills are up in front of Congress and how that influences social justice things. And they do quite a lot of work in behalf of the Indians, lobbying for Indians. And you know, we call this the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but I read a woman who is with the Native American group that lives up there. And she goes, this is not wilderness, this is our home. And these people are real clear on whether or not they want that place disrupted for oil or not. This area is home for one herd of 180,000 caribou. And this group of people have traditionally has always lived off that caribou. And if that caribou disappeared, that people would disappear. So there's other lots of good reasons, but
how many people live in this area?
Oh, it's very few in numbers. It's very few in numbers, but it's a people.
Yeah.
It's a people. Well, I hoped you you enjoyed the discussion. The one point that I wanted to make about having a way to do ethics, I think, is just the way we did it, was that your best method of doing ethics is discussing it with other people. I went to a conference on faith and ethics in the workplace, and that was one thing that I came away with. I went to this one-hour session, you know, because it was called something like a way of doing ethics. And I realized that I didn't really know that I have an exact way of making ethical decisions. I should have some sort of framework that I can just plug the new information into and have a way of doing it. And what came out of that was that the best way, the safest way, most practical way, of doing ethics and knowing that you're going to make the right decision is to discuss it with other people. That it's the processing information and hearing other voices, other sides, that leads to the best decisions. The best you can make, you can say that there are right decisions to be made. Now, you may not agree with this one, or you may have agreed with me before we ever started, but there's that. Thank you.
Eric, wait, just let me see this one.
I see. Yes, I enjoyed my job very much.
I'm sure you did. I enjoyed listening to you.
Are you going to going up to eat?
Mm-hmm. I'm always.
I sure don't need to eat.
I don't either, but I'm going with you. Yeah, those governments out there, they're stockpiling their gold.
Where do you live now?
They're investing in
California.
Oil.
Oh, yeah. You moved away from it. Yeah.
There's going to come a day.
Oh, yeah.
We'd love to see it.
Well, no. Well, there's a clock running backwards at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and it's at about 34 years.
For oil?
For oil.
It's getting so hungry.